So, for today's Dharma talk in the morning, I'm going to go a little bit deeper today. So, there won't be so many jokes as usual today. Because when we have a meditation retreat like this, we get people who's just starting their meditation, people who've been coming for many, many years. And it doesn't really matter whether you're a beginner or you've been meditating for many years. Just sometimes your meditation gets very deep. You really want to know what's going on. And even if you aren't close or you don't think you're close to these deep states of meditation, still it's very helpful to have the overview, the grand plan, to put this meditation in the context of the greater teachings of Buddhism, to see how it all fits together, especially with the arising of insight and seeing clearly what's going on in life, and also the liberation, you know, from samsara and nibbana, to get it all into context by having this big picture of the path of meditation, where mindfulness fits in, where precepts fit in, and where your understanding of Buddhism fits in. It's just a big picture. And it was many, many years ago when I decided to start teaching sort of deep teachings, things like what really non-self means, what nibbana means, and talking about the jhanas. And I remember when I first started talking about these things, I got quite a bit of criticism from other monks. I got criticism because they said, what are you talking about that for? These are only lay people, they'll never get jhanas. It's hard enough for monks to get jhanas without people living in a home. But I thought that was really unfair, and that was very sort of arrogant. And so I decided, well, let's see, give people a chance. So I started teaching some jhanas, and then all these things came out of the woodwork, people who had achieved jhanas before, and people who achieved them once you started talking about them. Not that many. So it actually had a lot of benefit, but there's also danger as well. And the danger is that when I start talking about these great meditation states and how wonderful they are and how incredible they are, everyone says, I want, gimme. Because that's our nature. When anything is on offer there, we always want it. And it's such an attractive thing that once you hear what they're like and what they do, you think, yeah, that's what I want to. So there is a danger in the talk I'm going to give right now, and that is, it's going to arise some craving. But always remember that the jhanas in particular, they're born of letting go. They're just stages of letting go. They're created of letting go. And their main enemy is wanting and desire. So every time you want something and desire something, you're walking in the opposite direction to these deep meditation states. You're making it more difficult for yourself. Every time you want, you expect, you crave, you grasp, you're going the opposite direction. And so basically this is just what happens when you let go, when you let go big time. And I say that because the first times when people came up and said they did experience these deep meditations, and they described them to me, and I said, okay, yeah, that's a jhana. The first few times I asked them, well, what did you do special this time? And now, when you've had deeper meditations, that's why I always ask you. Now, it may not be jhanas, you get some limiters, or you get very peace. In your interviews, I ask them, well, what did you do special? Why did that happen? And I ask you that because I want you to not spend so much time sort of delighting in the results, but spend more time examining the causes. Where did that come from? What brought those beautiful states about? Instead of just enjoying them, find out why. Because when you find out why, what caused the deep states of meditation, you learn how to recreate them. You learn why they arise. And that means that you've got more chance of generating them again and again and again and again until they become very easy for you. So it's where they come from, what caused them is really important. So I asked the first people who got these deep meditation states, what do you do special? And it was just a smile came onto my face when just about everybody said the same thing, maybe in slightly different words. But I remember one guy who said, for the first time, I really let go. And now I just dwell on that. For the first time, I really let go. And that's classic description All the other times you think you're letting go, you're only letting go of a tiny bit. When you really let go, full on, 100%, then these jhanas are just what happens as a result. And I think all of you who've been Buddhists a long time know that sometimes the biggest problem in Buddhism is called the attachments. You know, grasping, having too many attachments. Letting go is the opposite of attachment. Letting things go, disappear. Letting go of your family when you're here in this retreat. Letting go of your business and your boss when you're here on this retreat. Letting go of your financial situation when you're on this retreat. Look, it does not matter if you go home and find the stock market has plunged and you've lost all your assets. Don't worry, come back here and I'll ordain you as a monk or as a nun. You have nothing to worry about. So, you let go of all these things. But those are actually pretty easy to let go of. It's the harder things to let go of, as you found out, is your thinking and your controlling. That's the hardest thing, because we are all, to certain degrees, control freaks. One of my favorite words, control freaks. And yeah, we can maybe not control our finances. Yeah, we maybe can let go of our family. Yeah, we maybe let go of our finances. But the thing you can't let go of is your body and your mind. And so you control your body. You worry about it. You're concerned about it. Which means you get in a lake, you have to move. You get a scratch. You know, you got an itch, you have to scratch it. You know, all the time that we're so concerned about this body, that some of you already on this retreat, when the body's about to disappear, you get very frightened. Remember just one Singapore person, they started to get peaceful, only the first stage of peace. They were sitting there, and they got out of meditation, they came to see me straight away. Ajahn Brahm, my hands disappeared. I could not feel them. What's going on? I'm afraid. And the reason was, you know, because you can't feel your hands, you can't control them. They disappeared. I said, wonderful. Now let the rest of your body go as well. I said, well, what would happen? I said, you get into these beautiful meditations, you'll bliss out. And that's, you know, where I started telling people, just to encourage them to be able to let go. Yeah, it's a bit scary, but what happens? The bliss better than sex. That's my marketing slogan. You know, whenever you sort of, and that's a very good slogan too, because everybody's really interested when I say that. Even going into prisons and jails, you know, they say, what's this meditation business? Oh, it's bliss better than sex. Really? Teach us more. And it actually is accurate. So, when these things start to disappear, this is natural, this is what's supposed to happen. Because people start to let go, and the more you let go, the more things disappear. And the only way that you can really let go that much to know that it's really worthwhile is going to be something really incredibly beautiful on the other end. So you let go more and more and more until you really let go. You let go of all of your controlling, all your will, all your body, let it totally disappear. Let all your thoughts disappear. You let everything disappear until you really do become the passenger. With no levers, no buttons, nothing to control at all. You really are 100% passive. With no will, no choice, no doer, interfering with the process. Sometimes people do that, either because they're just totally frustrated, they've been doing things and it just does not work. And sometimes they say, I just give up. I've just had enough. And they sit there, and once they give up, everything happens. Vroom, 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 and they get into deep meditation. And it shows you just where it comes from really letting go. Letting go of grasping and see what it's like when you don't attach, when you don't own anything, where everything vanishes and disappears. All the Buddhist traditions talk about emptiness. And what is emptiness? It means when things have gone, they vanish, nothing left. They talk about cessation. So what happens? They talk about anicca, about it's not impermanence, it's things which were there all the time are no longer there for you. That's anicca. Nicca means something which is repeated, which is constant. And I said a few days ago, what's always there, you just don't notice. Even the air has a certain vibration, because it's always there, you don't notice it. If you take the air away, you notice it then. So what's happening is that when things disappear, you get closer to emptiness, and they disappear because you're letting go. And the whole path of letting go is this path of deep meditation called the jhanas. And again, I decided to try and teach these and see what happens. And people did attain these. And also I was quite surprised at, that sometimes these things happen naturally to people. They weren't even Buddhists. A classic example was, I was teaching a retreat in Penang, where I usually teach a retreat every year, a long retreat once every 2 years. And, you know, I'm a kind guy. So when somebody said, look, I know this person's not on the retreat, but they've had some psychological problems, they need some counselling, all the other counsellors has not been able to help them. You know, so as a last resort, you know, I'm the monk of last resort usually. Can you please talk to this woman? And they never told me what the psychological problem was. So, you know, you get all sorts of problems, weird problems, ordinary problems. But this was a unique problem. Because she came in, she was quite disturbed. And as she was talking, I said, what's the problem? And of course, I hadn't had any information at all what the problem was. And she described what had happened to her. And as she described it, because I'm, you know, one of the experts in these things, I said, madam, that was a jhana. And I told her all the other things which she would have experienced. And she nodded and smiled. Alas, someone understood what she'd gone through. Because it was so weird and strange and powerful, she'd assumed she'd gone crazy. I said, that wasn't craziness. That was a marvelous meditation experience. You just fluked it somehow or other. You just pressed that letting go button and it happened. Well done. It was a wonderful time for me because I was so happy that someone had got a deep state. And she was so happy that someone had understood and confirmed that I understood, because I added all the other details which she hadn't told me. You know, because we know these states. And then she went away, one happy lady. She didn't pay a fee. Because I don't want a fee. My fee was that another person that experienced one of these deep states. Whoopee. Gives me a lot of joy. And several people have had those experiences. You know, they haven't even been Buddhists. They haven't got a clue what they were doing. They just let go big time. And that's what happened. So I'm going to describe these experiences to you and how they occur. So it gives you the big picture of meditation and also explains to you why I teach like I do. Now I encourage you, just good enough. Stop striving. Let things be. Just relax. If you're tired, take a rest. Now if you want to go for a walk, have a walk, have a cup of tea. Sometimes people think I'm a very soft monk. And if you really want to do a retreat and you don't like any others, come to Ajahn Brahm's retreat because it's really easy. This is for the namby-pamby cream puffs of Singapore. And if you really want a really tough retreat, go to one of these Goenka ones or something. But it's not. Because I do this, you know, understanding exactly what I'm doing or why I'm doing it. Because as you let go, as you say this is good enough, all your craving and all your wanting and controlling tends to disappear. Because I don't control you, I hope that you won't control yourself. I never order you to get up and go down. We don't ring the bell except for lunch or breakfast, and that's out of kindness for you, because I want you to enjoy your meals. We don't have a bell at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning. That's why some years ago, I made a joke. It's a terrible joke. I did say there'd be no jokes, but this is the only one, and you wish you hadn't heard it after I tell it. In Buddhism, in meditation retreats, we have this practice of noble silence. And some people think that noble silence means you're not allowed to speak. But that's not what noble silence means. Noble silence means no bell silence. I showed you wish you hadn't heard that terrible joke. So no bells. And how many times have you been at work, at school, even in concentration camps they have bells to get you up and tell you what to do, when you want to do it. It's all controlling. So this is a no-bell silence retreat. So we're not controlling anybody. And you do that on purpose. Because if we have no-bell silence, there is a chance that a few of you might get a jhana. When you get a jhana because of a no-bell silence, we say that you win. This is even worse joke than the Nobel Peace Prize. And that's a jhana. That's a Nobel, no controlling, Peace Prize. It's terrible. Why are you laughing then? But anyway. So when you really start to sort of, you know, let go of things, you know, a strange thing happens. Everything that wanting and craving promised you, you get when you stop the wanting. You often think to yourself, why do you want something? Why do you crave for it? What are you reaching out for? You're reaching out because, you know, this thing, you know, which you're reaching out for, promises you happiness, fulfillment, peace. But once you get this, then you can really relax. You don't need to crave anymore. That's why many people say, all I want is, you know, to win the lottery. All I want is to fall in love. All I want is to have enough money to retire. And once you get that, you want something more. The object of your craving will always be unfaithful to you. It will promise you the world, but just give you more craving. That's why the wanting has no end. That's why there's never any peace. It always drives you ever forward without ever giving you a moment of rest. It's a journey which has no resting place, wanting. But it promises you so much. And after a while, you look at your life, how hard you've worked, how much you've sacrificed. You've really put so much into, you know, your life, your career. And it's hurt many times, but it doesn't matter. You think, if I just try that harder, if I run that little bit faster, if I struggle just that extra little bit of effort, it'll be worthwhile. Has it been worthwhile? So in the end, this bald-headed monk comes up and says, you've been running in the wrong direction. And you go totally against everything you've ever been taught. He says, just relax. Stop. Don't strive. Good enough. Just let it be. And that's such a hard thing to accept. Because I'm going totally against the stream of everything you've been taught. But some of you have enough faith in me, or you've had enough experience of just trying it out just for a few seconds, to know when you do just leave it alone, everything becomes very beautiful and nice. Some of you have had enough letting go to get some joy up, some peace. And from some of you, it may be the first time in your whole life you've ever experienced any peace. If it is, what a wonderful achievement that is. In your whole life, that's the first time. Somebody asked me to do an interview. It was actually Pei Chong, for I don't know why, in the BF. And they were talking about my first meditation experiences as a layperson. The first meditation I ever did was so profound, so impressive, that I never forget. It was one of those experiences. Well, I remember all the details, even the place. It was in the Wordsworth room of King's College, Cambridge. It was only a 5-minute meditation. It was the first time I'd ever experienced anything close to peace. And I had enough sensitivity, enough wisdom to recognize that this was really important. I didn't know why. I didn't have any philosophy of Buddhism to understand what I'd experienced. But I knew that this was so important, so wonderful. I tasted just a tiny bit of peace. And of course later on you took that much deeper. But that little bit of peace which you've experienced already may encourage you just to take this letting go that little step further and see what happens next. Because that's all this meditation is. My job is to try and stop you, to trick you, to brainwash you, anything to stop you interfering with the process. Just sit down, please, and shut up. Leave it alone. It's good enough. You don't need to get anything, go anywhere, be anybody. Just be content. Be happy to be here. They're tricking you by saying you don't have to worry about the lunch, it's coming. You don't have to worry about anything, you're totally safe, secure, everything is fine, you don't have to do an absolute thing. And you still keep planning and doing and worrying and complaining. But every now and again you just say, okay, I'm just going to sit here. Sit here and just be and don't do anything. Because once you stop doing things, you rest. All the energy of your mind can only go into one thing, into what I call the knower. I split up this mind, and it's an accurate description. The two halves of your mind, of anyone's mind, is the knower and the doer. The doer is the active mind. It what tries to remember what I'm talking about. It decides what it's going to do next. It controls, it thinks, it plans, it reacts. It's the active part of your mind, what I call the doer. That is what's responsible for all your thinking. That's what keeps you moving. That's what drives you from one thing to another. Constantly doing something. If not outside, in your mind, in your head. Now that takes up so much of your inner energy. So much there's hardly any left at all for knowing. The doer gets the lion's share. 99.99% of all your energy. Which is why when people stop doing, they fall asleep. Why? Because your knower has been starved of energy for such a long time. When you stop doing things, when you rest, when you relax, when you don't worry, when you don't plan, when you don't remember the things of the past, when your mind is free from all this having to do something, the energy has an opportunity to flow into the knowing. It's not wasted anymore. And as it goes into the knowing, you literally wake up. Your mindfulness gets stronger. Your inner world gets energized. I sometimes notice, when I'm reading journals, science journals, the current epidemic which is spreading through the world, which is probably even worse than cancer, is depression. You probably know many people have suffered from depression. You may have suffered yourself from time to time with depression. This is the big depressions. Many of us have minor episodes of depression when we get really fed up and everything becomes grey and lifeless and nothing interests us at all. And I understand that one of the main causes of the current epidemic of depression is that we work so hard, we run so fast, we do much more in this age than your parents ever did. Much more is demanded of you, at work and at home. You fit so much more into every week. That's why your mind is tired. So much energy goes into doing things, that your knower, your mindfulness, is so weak and tired, it just can't see clearly. It's got no energy, it's got no oomph, it's not got any power behind it. Which means that what you see is grey, what you taste is tasteless. The life has no meaning, no joy, no bite to it. And you see sort of like a monk like me who should be very boring. What do I do to enjoy myself? But I've got all this energy and crack jokes and bubble around the retreat center. Where the heck does this energy come from, Ajahn Brahm? You're not depressed. You should be depressed. Just your lifestyle. And where it comes from is the energy which goes into the now. I don't do so much. I know how to relax and make my mind very peaceful. And because of that, you get all this beautiful energy coming up into your mind. When you let go of the doer, you get energy, you get mindfulness, you get happiness. And this is a path of meditation. You sit there first of all, the first couple of days of any retreat, you will be tired. I accept that. That's why we built this retreat, because I designed this retreat place basically. Designed it so it can be a place where you can get jhanas. So you have got your beds, you can go and rest any time. Get rid of that sleepiness, be kind to yourself. Get the energies coming up again, and this time of the retreat your energy should be starting to rise. Things are a bit more interesting. You know, the sun sets, the clouds, the trees, everything begins to become more beautiful. And as your mindfulness increases, then it's easier to let go a little bit more when you sit down and close your eyes. Just like you watch the trees when I've seen you having your tea or your breakfast out on the alfresco area, or just walking around, just looking and enjoying, not doing anything, just being. And I see you starting to enjoy yourself. That means it's more possible you can sit down on your seat and just enjoy yourself. Just watch this moment. Not trying to get anywhere. When you watch a tree, you're not trying to make that tree any different than it already is. You're not telling the birds to fly higher. You're not telling the clouds to move faster. You're just loving them for what they are. And that's how you look at your mind when you sit down and close. All these thoughts which are running through your mind like clouds. You're not asking them to stop. You're not asking them to go faster. It is clouds, none of my business. You can stand back and just enjoy. You're not doing anything. And just like the clouds this morning have now passed and the sky is blue. At least it was when I came in. This is what happens, just like the clouds, they pass. And the thoughts pass when you don't fight them. If you fight the mind, you just create more clouds, more thoughts, more disturbances. When you let everything be, when you don't do anything, the knower gets very bright, and the doer, the very cause of all this agitation, called thinking, called remembering, all that striving and that stress vanishes, and everything becomes very still. So the first thing which becomes still in a natural order of things is when we just be. Time loses its meaning. What is the past anyway? Just old memories, and you can never be sure whether your memories are accurate or not. For example, where did you put your shoes outside the door? Do you remember whether on the left or the right, which way they were pointing? You put them there, but can you remember? Chances are that what you think you did, you didn't do. I don't know how many people look for their shoes and they find they didn't bring them here, they left them outside the cottage. Sometimes people park their car at night at Dhammaloka and they come back to me and say, someone stole my car, someone stole my car. No, they just parked at the other place. Even I must put my hand up. That when I started wearing glasses, these are just reading glasses, but I usually put them on all the time now. Because once I was very late and having to go into Nolamara to give the talk. And just at the bottom of the drive I realized I forgot my glasses. And so I asked the driver, please turn around, it's only just the bottom of the hill, it'll only be 5 minutes so I can pick up my glasses. And he turned around and said, Ajahn Brahm, they're on your nose. Well, this happens to everyone, wedding. That's why you wear it all the time, so at least I know where it is now. So your memory is very uncertain. You don't know what happened, why it happened. So just leave it all alone. The future, actually, I mean, I had lots and lots of plans for the future, and all my plans never came to fruition. If you'd have asked me when I was at Cambridge that one day I'd be a monk, sort of, you know, in Australia, teaching people from Singapore, I'd think that's totally impossible. No way. And same with you. You know, 5, 10 years ago, you know, would you think that you weren't in Chennai, that you'd be in Australia, you know, going on retreats, you know, in this land? You wouldn't have thought that was possible 10 years ago. But now you're here. The future. You can define the future as the unexpected. That's your future. Unexpected, haven't got a clue what's going to happen next. To me, that's beautiful. If my future was planned and I knew exactly what was going to happen, that'd be so boring. It wouldn't be alive anymore. That would be just like some robot, some program. So the uncertainty is actually quite nice. But it also means, because it's uncertain, because I cannot capture it, you know, with sort of imagination of what it might be, that means I can leave it alone. I know it's my business because it's out of my hands. I can't do anything. So I leave it alone. So the first letting go is letting go of time. And it's a good opportunity to remind you of that. Because some people are already worried. What day is it today? How many more days have you got for this retreat? Ah, only a couple of days left. What am I going to do? Don't think this two days? What day is it today? It's Thursday, isn't it? Is that right? So you've got 2 days left. That's 48 hours. That is 2,880 minutes. That is about, I don't know, what is that? That's about 160,000 seconds. That's a lot of seconds you've got left. And any second you get enlightened, any second you get into jhanas. Something just like that. So you've got 160,000 opportunities left. You've got heaps of time. Relax. 160,000 seconds left. It doesn't really matter if I waste a couple. So please don't get imprisoned by your conception of time. For the most of your life you've been in that prison, and it hurts, and it's totally useless. That's why in this retreat, in this hall here, there's no clock, except what I've got over here, but you can't see that one. So you haven't got a clue what's going on. I know I've threatened this, I'll do this one day. I will confiscate your clocks when you come on retreat one day, and I'll take all the clocks off the wall. And I will not let you know what time it is. So you have got no conception at all, except that the light comes up at dawn, the sun goes down in the evening. So you don't know what's going on. Wouldn't that be nice? You get paranoid, you get so afraid. I'm not going to miss my lunch, I'm going to miss the chant, I'm going to miss this, I'm going to miss that. It just shows you how much of a prisoner you are at the time. You don't have to be. It's okay. So we let go of that time. And then we let go of all this thinking business. Now after a while the thinking stops because there's nothing much to think about in this place. What are you going to think about? You know, lunch? You know, lunch, whether you think about it or not, it's going to come. Thinking about it's not going to make it come any quicker. So just waste the time thinking about it. After a while, because there's very little to think about, you stop thinking. Everything is just too perfect. You don't have to worry about anything. There's no business to be done. You're not in control of this place, so it's not your business. It's Dania's business or my business, none of your business. Beautiful. So after a while your thinking stops. Quite naturally, whether you like it or not, you think less and less and less. Until some days you're just sitting there in your rooms just staring at the curtains. Wonderful, you're getting somewhere. But of course, you just let it go. Then you sit down and you meditate. And the main thing you let go of is again this body. And that is where meditation really starts. Because it's pretty easy to let go of thinking and let go of time. But letting go of your body, that's a tough one. Because you really are attached to this big time. That's why whenever the doctor comes and says, "I'm sorry, madam, there's a lump there in your breast. I'm sorry, sir, that is a cancer." You get paranoid, you get so afraid. "Ah, I'm dying." No, you're not. It's none of your business. It's just body, that's all. You've had so many bodies. How many times have you died already? Thousands, millions of times. So next time the doctor said, "I'm sorry, it's terminal." Okay, here we go again. They've been there, done that. That's why, you know, that I always like to mention Dr. K. Sri Dhammananda. Many of you know him. He was a chief priest at Brickfields Temple in Malaysia. And in his biography, you know, the doctor, his doctor, when diagnosed that the cancer was terminal, it's a terrible thing for a doctor to do. You have to tell the patient that, you know, there's no treatment, basically. Prolong life a little bit, but basically, you know, you're going to die. And so here he goes again, this doctor having to tell another patient they're going to die. So he told him, you know, he's a monk, so you should be able to take it. So, you know, you're going to die, it's terminal. And Dr. K. Sri Dhammananda burst out laughing. He thought it was so funny. And the doctor had never seen anybody like that before. When you're told you're going to die, you think, "Wow, whoopee. Siffity doodah. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu." So that was a sign that that fellow, even though, you know, we never thought he meditated much, at least he wasn't attached to his body. So every time you sit meditation, you're learning how to die. This is dying practice. You sit down there, you let everything stop. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, physical touch. Just like you're going to have to do one day when you really die. And all your senses turn off one by one. I don't know if you've ever been with a person who's dying. It's great being a monk because sometimes you're with them when they die. And, you know, I always thought the first time, I thought you die, you just 1 minute you're there and then next minute you're gone. But it's not like that. It's a process which goes on after a couple of minutes at least. And I asked the doctor, I said, "When did he die?" He said, "I don't know. 2 minutes ago he was alive. Now he's dead. Somewhere in between." Because the dying is a slow process. When senses turn off and the brain stops, everything else stops. It's a process, not an event. And this is like your meditation. You let go of the senses as a process, just one by one. It's not that hard to do. You know, you often let go of, as I say, let go of seeing. Because seeing apparently takes up most neural space in your brain. You know, we're visual creatures mostly. So, you close your eyes. And I see blackness. Because the blackness doesn't move, it vanishes. It shows you that this stillness, when you don't move, you don't do things. That's the way you let go of things. Doing creates the attachments. It creates the world. When you stop doing things and you're still, your world vanishes. It disappears. And that's the heart of meditation. Stillness, vanishing, emptiness, wisdom. In that sequence. So you sit here still, not doing things. You don't try and get rid of seeing. It just goes. Smelling and tasting. Each one of you has got saliva. Now you're aware of it, because I mentioned it. It was always there, and now you have to swallow. It doesn't change that much, and after a while it will disappear again. It's always there, but because it's not a problem, or it's somebody else's problem, not my problem, then it vanishes. And the big senses, which are very hard to let go of, as hearing and a physical touch. Physical touch because the body is incredibly irritating. You know, you're having to scratch your eye, you're having to sort of scratch your foot, you're coughing, you know, you're scratching your side, you see people moving, you're moving your hand from one place to another, you're flexing your hand, you are scratching your mouth. I'm scratching my nose because it just itched. It's actually great a mindfulness technique just to watch, you know, naturally without interfering, just what you do. You can't stay still. Why can't you stay still? Because there's this irritation which is always there with your body. Constantly, throughout the day, you can't sit still, motionless, for more than about 5 or 10 seconds before another irritation comes up. Blinking your eyes is an irritation. Moving your legs, scratching your knee. All these things. You're all doing it, so I'm not just pointing at one person. It shows you just how irritating this body is. But because it's always been there, you've had the irritation all the time, you just take it for granted, you don't notice it anymore. But then when you sit still and your body disappears, I don't need to scratch anymore. I don't need to move. There's no aches, no pains, nothing which I need to do. Don't need to cough. Don't need to sneeze. Got no feeling I want to go to the toilet. No hunger in my tummy. Nothing there at all. You know, that's incredible bliss. It's like this body is your office, your place of work. And you have to work there 24 hours a day. Even when you're asleep, you move around in the bed. But now, you're on holiday. You don't have to worry about the body at all. You just can't even feel it. It's gone. And this is what happens in a meditation. Your body disappears, stage by stage, whether it's the hands or the legs, you know, the head. As I say, usually the breath is one of the last things to disappear, because that's still moving. But then, with the breath meditation, just watching this breath go in and out, calming it down, and the difference between the in-breath and the out-breath tends to disappear. Everything becomes very even. Just a smooth flow of breath. You don't know whether it's going in or going out. Because there's a sameness there in every moment of breath, it disappears. You don't know you're breathing anymore. Already somebody asked me in the interviews, do they get scared? They think they stop breathing. And if you think you stop breathing, you will get scared, because that's dangerous for your health to stop breathing. But you are breathing. You're just taking your awareness away from it now. The body's doing the breathing, and you're not feeling it at all. Sound is one of the other hard ones to let go of. But you know, you can do that. You do that. If you're even reading a book, and it's a really interesting book, you get into your own world in the book, and you can't hear sounds around you. This is what happens when you focus on something more interesting. So as the body relaxes and disappears, and you get very interested in the silence, in the peace, you just thought sounds are like thousands of miles away. And many of you experience that, sitting here. Yeah, there are sounds, but they're way over there, you can hardly hear them at all. You're conscious of them, but they're not disturbing you until they disappear altogether. And that is when you start the very deep meditations. You've let go of your body. And that's a big letting go. It can only happen through stillness, which is why the more you do, the more you agitate, this will not happen. Stillness means things disappear, your body vanishes. And please don't be worried at all that when you're not looking over your body, when you're not controlling it, things will go wrong. As I only mentioned to you about that guy who was immersed in water in a flood, or in the stories about the monk who was put on the fire, they thought he was dead, he was totally invulnerable. That's what happens in these deep meditations. Nothing can harm you at all. So you don't have to be afraid. The point is that you think if you're not feeling the body, that you're totally vulnerable. Someone can come and pick you up, take you out, they can do all sorts of things to you, and you get very afraid. But the reality is that you are more safe than ever before. And the health benefits, just are huge, enormous. Many people have their sicknesses totally vanish when they go to these deep meditations. Cancers in both lungs, fevers, all sorts of diseases tend to just vanish. And you know that if you ever have a deep experience, I've been telling this to quite a few people in the interviews, even myself, if I meditate for an hour and a half and I don't get into a deep meditation, afterwards I'm stiff. Now you've got to stretch a bit because you feel a bit of an ache here and ache there. I've got very good posture because I've been sitting so much for so many years. My body is pretty loose. But still you get a bit stiff. But sometimes you meditate for 4 or 5 hours. And the first time I did a very, very long sit, I think, my God, this is going to be very painful when I come out. 4 or 5 hours and I haven't been moving at all. And you must be stiff. But you come out of the deep meditations and you've got no pain at all. Your body is just so loose, like it's had a huge massage. And you think you just run a mile. You probably could, very easily. But you don't feel like, you want to sort of disturb the peace that much. But the point is, you're just so still and so peaceful that the body is just so healthy, it feels just so good. There's not an ache or a pain or an itch in the whole body. And if you had a cough before, you won't have a cough afterwards. You'll be perfect health. That's the result of these samadhi experiences. And I say that just to encourage you that there's nothing to be afraid of, but quite the opposite, everything to gain when your body disappears from your consciousness. And when that happens, what are you aware of? Because people worry that my breath disappears, what am I supposed to watch? Whatever's there, you don't choose. Just let it happen. See what's coming on next on the TV. You don't need to switch channels. So in that stage of meditation, remember, don't switch channels. Just see what's coming up next. And what's coming up next is the great Nimitta, the Nimitta program. It just comes up. You see these beautiful lights. And that's the reason why you see those lights, is because your 5 senses have disappeared. And now you can see the mind. Just in the same way I mentioned when you die, you go towards the light in the same way. Because you're mostly visual beings, that's how we experience the Nimittas. They are not lights. You're not seeing these on your retina. Your eyes are just not working. It's a pure mental image. But this is the way we interpret it. And again, it took me a long time just investigating these Nimittas, experiencing them, to realize what they were. And also to understand such questions as people say, what about the different colors? Now, is blue better than purple? Or about the gold Nimitta or the white Nimitta? What's the best color? And it was a good question. So I looked in my Nimitta range and they're all the same. I added the yellow color. I added the purple color. They're actually all the same. The experience was the same. This is what my perception added onto it. And I realized just how powerful this perception is. What you have there, everybody experiences exactly the same thing when you see the Nimitta. But we add those details. Sometimes what we expect. Sometimes it's just favorite colors. Sometimes colors which we expect to be deep and vivid and psychic. It's what we add onto those things. Because this is where we're coming into pure mind objects. And pure mind objects, there's something the same there. The sort of paper on which this image is drawn. But many of the colors and shapes, we add them. They come from us. So you don't really worry at all what the color is. Or even the shape. The 2 things which are important about Nimittas are its brilliance and power. Just how bright the light is, how beautiful it is. And the second thing is how stable it is. It doesn't move. Those two are connected. The longer it's still, the more energy goes to it and the brighter it becomes. That's why that sometimes when nimittas come up, they move around and they disappear. They lose all their power. That's why I said last night, that beautiful simile of Ajahn Chah, like the animals coming out of the jungle, you just sit perfectly still. And if you do, those animals will come and play for a long time. And they're incredibly beautiful animals. And if you know how to use the nimittas, being still, don't do anything. These nimittas will give you an enormous amount of happiness and joy. Even at those stages, this hasn't even got to jhanas yet, there's bliss which is far better than sexual orgasm, which lasts for longer if you know how to stabilize these things. Brilliant, beautiful lights. Even at that light stage, and I'm telling personal experiences now, that sometimes, early on in my meditation, I thought that no human being could actually take so much ecstasy. That it's impossible, you can't take that much. Some it's going to blow. But one insight which I found from experience, you can always take more bliss. You don't explode. I'm being honest with you about these things, to show you what happens. You don't need to be afraid. Sometimes people are afraid because they think they can't handle it, they can't take it. Yes, you can. Some people have guilt, they think they don't deserve it. Yes, you do. You do deserve this. So, if these nimittas disappear, check out, why are they going? A lot of times it is because of guilt. We think we don't deserve to have such bliss. Me? Yeah, maybe if you're a monk, you do good things, and these pure-hearted people always give donations and help out, but me, I'm lazy, I don't ever give a donation, I don't keep my precepts, no, I don't deserve these things. Yes, you do. I got one person to write it on a piece of paper and put it on his office. I deserve ecstasy. I don't mean the drug, I mean actually the real thing. Just so it could brainwash him again and again and again, so that when these things came up he didn't sort of push them aside because he thought he didn't deserve them. You do. So let them come, let them grow. And when they do, they become so still, and they become incredibly brilliant and bright. You're getting into some amazing states now. Don't be afraid. The reason why people get afraid is because they get so powerful that sometimes you can't think you can't control these things. You can't. They're much bigger than you. Far bigger and more powerful than you. It's like coming across a powerful tiger in the jungle. You think, my goodness, that thing could eat me. The nimittas are far more powerful than that. But they're totally benign. They'll never harm you. In fact, they'll give you the greatest gifts of bliss, freedom, and even enlightenment. So when they come, even though they're powerful, no, don't be afraid. Just let them be. It's just the Dhamma, just like the Buddha coming to see you. Very powerful, very wise, but so compassionate. You're saying, I don't need to be afraid at all. So when those nimittas come up, you just let them be. If they start moving around, going backwards and forwards, up and down, that is because you are moving backwards and forwards, going up and down. The simile which helped me was to realize that these nimittas, these lights, are like looking at your mind, yourself, if you like, in a mirror. And when my nimittas first started coming up, I tried to stop them moving backwards and forwards. It was like looking at my face in the mirror and holding the mirror. You can hold the mirror as tightly as you can, but if you, the looker, are moving up and down, of course the image in the mirror is moving up and down. And so I realized that the nimitta was moving up and down because me, the observer, was moving. I had to be more still. I had to go to that next level of stillness. When I was still, the nimitta was still. It was a reflection of my mind. So my nimitta got very still, and it just got really, really strong. That's where you get these incredible bliss states. And of course, anyone who's got kindness and compassion, I want to give you the very best. You know, just as you would like to give me the best. Sometimes people, they make my breakfast and they make my lunch. And they try their very hardest to give me the very, very, very best. And that's why I'm so very, very fat. But I enjoy it. So I try and get your mind very fat with beautiful nimittas. So when they do come, please enjoy them. And it makes me very, very, very happy if I see that, you know, you guys get nimittas and you really bliss out. That's the joy of a teacher. To see that, you know, the great sort of happinesses which I found, you're beginning to share. So if you ever want to say thank you, you get one of those nimittas and come and tell me. You never need to say thank you anymore. Say, well done. I've fulfilled my part of the bargain now. I've given you that incredible bliss. But what happens next is even more profound. This is beautiful nimittas. It gets so bright and so beautiful. And very often people feel them being sucked into the nimitta, drawn in. It's so powerful, so beautiful. It's tough sometimes, because you realize if you go in, you're going to have to let go a little bit more. What you let go of is your sense of who you think you were, your sense of self, your ego, your idea of yourself. In particular, even much more of your ability to control and do things. At the nimitta stage, yes, you're letting go, but you're letting go voluntarily. Always knowing that you can actually interfere at any time you want, if you need to. You just decide not to. Decide to leave it alone. But going into the jhana, you can't even decide to let go anymore. All the decisions, all the control is totally removed from you. And that's one of the scariest things. For many people it's like losing your sense of self, losing your soul, losing who you think you are, totally. And that's the hardest thing to let go of, yourself. It's not really you, but it's just this illusion, this phantom which is built up over many, many lifetimes. But you know what happens, you're on the edge of these jhanas, you're already blissing out, you're just looking over the edge, and it's even more bliss. You don't want to go because it's scary, but it's just so nice on the other side. But I can't go. It's frightening. But it's so nice. But I'm going to lose everything. What the hell, I'm going. It is actually the joy, the bliss, the profundity which just drags you in spite of yourself. And literally means in spite of yourself. You just get dragged in there. The pleasure principle is a very important part of this whole process. Just the sheer bliss and pleasure of it. We're pleasure-loving beings. Humans, just we get even more profound and deeper pleasure in these deep jhanas, we just get drawn in spite of ourselves, in spite of our fears, in spite of anything, we just get in there, in these incredible, profound states, so absolutely still, you begin to understand what peace can be. And again, I quote the Buddha here. The Buddha said, whatever you imagine it to be, is something different. Even with all the descriptions which I give, you won't really get it. It won't be like that. But after you've gone into a jhana, you'll understand why I talk like that, why the Buddha talked like that. It's not like this, but that's about as close as you can get to describe it. A totally different experience. Beautiful, incredible peace. You've disappeared. And you stay in those states for long periods of time. Sometimes people have asked me that. It's tough to actually to say how long. But look, you know, if it's less than a half an hour, it's not really a jhana. If you get in those deep jhanas, you're in there for a long time. Don't be worried. You're having the time, not the time of your life, the time of your many lives. You'll never, ever, ever regret these days. In Buddhism, we call them Uttari Manusa Dhamma. More than the usual human state. These are the states which even the Buddha said is just so close to enlightenment. He said what you feel in those states, he called it Sambodhi Sukha. Enlightenment bliss. It's not enlightenment, but it's close enough to give you a taste of what freedom truly is. You experience these states, but you cannot think within them. These are so still that any thought, any description, any naming is impossible. It's like you're stuck in bliss which is not moving. That's even the first jhana. It just develops after a while into a second jhana where there's absolute stillness. Nothing moves at all. It's weird that you can experience such a state where nothing ever changes for hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. Totally still. You ask the person what you're aware of. Bliss. Unchanging. Deep. Powerful. Better than anything you've ever felt before. And this is one of the other amazing things of the jhanas. You think you know what happiness is. You don't. You haven't got a clue what happiness is. What pleasure is. You get into the first jhana and you think there can be nothing more blissful than that. Then you get a second jhana and it's even more blissful. Where is this going to end? Let's see what's next. Bliss upon bliss upon bliss. Stillness. And these are all coming from letting go. People who say, you're going to get attached to those pleasures. You can't get attached to them because they're born of letting go. It's totally opposite of attachment. If you get attached, they vanish. You're not in there, there's nobody in there to attach to anything. It's just what happens when you detach, when you really let go. You get these incredible blisses. And so you enjoy yourself to the max. And when you come out afterwards, and you can't tell yourself when you're going to come out, you can't move within those states, you're totally stuck. So if you get into one of those states after I finish this talk, sorry, beginner, you're going to lose lunch. You're going to miss your lunch. You're not going to get lunch at all. But don't worry, you won't want lunch. Oh, this is so wonderful. Who wants lunch? And I've got this incredible bliss and happiness. That'll keep you buzzing for days. So don't have to worry about anything. So while you're in there, you just cannot move. You're totally, you know, I can come up to you and say, Danny, yeah, come on, you've got to make lunch for people. She won't be able to hear me at all. Absolutely not. I can shout, I can hit her over the back. She won't feel anything. That's one of the nice things about the jhanas. You're right inside and you're just out of contact with the outside world. No one can reach you. Beautiful. So be careful sometimes, if you see someone like that, don't think that, you know, they're ignoring you, and hit them harder, or shout louder. You can't reach them, they're away, having a great time, just wait for them to come out. When you do come out from one of these jhanas, of course, one of the most profound experiences you've ever had. It's just so peaceful, so wonderful. Very often you go straight back in again, because that was good, I want more. You just go back in, just naturally. But eventually when you come out, finish, it was such an amazing experience. Blown away, totally different than anything you've ever expected. The best happiness, deep stillness and peace. You know there's something very, very spiritually, religiously, philosophically profound there. But it'll take a while for you to work it all out. But these are experiences which you can never forget. Usually, I like to compare it, but the only comparison which I know about is trauma. If you've had a very bad accident, crashed the car and come very close to dying, fell off a cliff, or anything else which has scared the shit out of you, you can't forget it. Sometimes you need to go to psychologists and therapists to try and get the memory away. Why? Because they're intense experiences which leave an indelible mark on your memory. That's what a jhana is like, only wholly positive. You just can't forget it. You just can't get rid of it, because it's intense, it's powerful. Which is why, after you emerge from these jhanas, you just look back upon them. Wow, what was that? That was amazing. Sometimes you can come and ask a monk like me, but really, you just investigate it for yourself. and you find out what it really was and why it was. When you've let go of craving, you'd have everything that craving promised and more. Bliss, peace, meaning, profundity. It really weakens your craving enormously. You will not want so much in life. You'll be living far more simply. Why? Because when I want, I just get trouble. When I let go, I get incredible bliss. You're learning things like Second Noble Truth. Craving is the problem. Wanting stops you being happy. I want to be happy. It's one of those oxymorons, like military intelligence, as they say. The oxymoron is two words put together which mean the opposite of each other. Like crazy wisdom. It's either crazy or it's wisdom. It can never be both. And that's like, you know, what I was saying about the wisdom and freedom. No, rather craving. Craving and happiness. If you crave for happiness, you're either craving or you're happy. You can't have both. You see those things, and so you let go. You let go more and more. You realize real happiness is not the freedom of craving, but the freedom from craving. So you're sitting here totally happy. This is good enough. And you also see in those states, why are these states so blissful? Where does this happiness come from? And you realize the first jhana is very clear. What is missing? What is missing is your body and all the five senses. And that's why you're blissed out. The first time your body has really gone full time. Oh, it's so nice not to have a body. And the second jhana, your will is gone. You can't do anything. No choice. It's not scary. That is actually blissful. When I'm not here. When my interfering mind, doing, worrying, judging mind, when that's all totally gone. Wow. Now that's very blissful. That's very nice. You understand that body is suffering. That will is suffering. And you always think that will doing is fun. What will I do today? How can I exert my will to create a better world? By willing, you are creating a worse world. Too many do-gooders, and I mean that in a very profound sense, let things be. Shh. That's one of the best things you can ever do for the world, to be still and show other people that stillness is possible. Show other people you don't need anything to be happy. Just let go. And there's happiness for you. It goes against all the idea of human progress. Sometimes people sort of intuit that this world is going in the wrong direction. Always doing and trying to make the world better. We feel maybe we're just making it worse. Sometimes we see that for ourselves. The harder you strive and struggle with all the best intentions, you just make more problems. So you just go in the opposite direction, let things be. Stop. And there the world gets better. Counterintuitive, but once you know peace and meditation and Dhamma, actually it's true. Too many people are running around helping each other. No one is helping themselves. No one is being still. No one is letting go. So you be the one who lets go. And let someone else be the one who lets go. Be peace. So when you stop all this willing, or you realize what it's like to be absolutely still and peaceful, when you have disappeared. Number one, you know that will is suffering. And because it disappears, you know it's got nothing to do with you. You are not in control of your body or mind. Every time you make a choice, you think you made the choice. No, you did not. That was totally conditioned. You had no choice at all but to come to this retreat. Don't think that you freely chose to come here. the conditions, everything made you come here. Don't think that you chose to sit in that particular seat. You had no choice but to sit in the seat you're sitting in right now. Otherwise you'd be in another seat. It appears that you're in total control, that you can choose. You can't. You are brainwashed. I know that. You admit it. I gave a talk years ago, Why I Tell Bad Jokes. I gave the reason. It's nothing to do with me, so don't blame me if I tell a bad joke. I can't help myself. It is my conditioning. Why? Because my father told bad jokes. And I've got his genes. It's in my genes, it's in my blood, it's in my condition. I can't help myself. No more than you can't help yourself to meditate. You've got no choice. I'm sorry, but it's already too late. You're going to get jhana, you're going to get enlightened, I'm sorry. But you've already gone too far. You've already been brainwashed way too deeply. You'll struggle. I don't want, I want to live the life, I want to get married, I want to have kids, I want to sort of be rich. Sorry. Too late now. You should have come on this retreat. Because I noticed the conditioning is incredibly powerful and deep. Especially when you start talking about those profound states. So the reason I talk like this is not just to give you the big picture. I know exactly what I'm doing. It is a bit devious, I admit it. But I'm doing this because I know how wonderful it is to experience these states. Because I'm talking about them. The seed has already been planted. You won't be able to resist now. You're going to get there. Sooner or later. Struggle, strive, cry. Say, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to believe in Ajahn Brahm. But you will. And you get these incredible, powerful states. The will is not yours. It's a wonderful thing to know that. It means you're totally free of having to worry about whether you succeed or fail. What other people think of you. Think of who? What do you mean think of Ajahn Brahm? Think of what? It's just will, that's all. It's conditioning. It's Ajahn Chah's fault. This is, he taught me. So anything I say, don't blame me. Blame Ajahn Chah. Don't blame Ajahn Chah. Blame Ajahn Brahm. That's where he got it from. In the end, the buck stopped with the Buddha. That's true, because you know, it's this conditioning. Conditioning all the way down the line, and now it's conditioned you. So that's where your will comes from. And now, when you start talking about non-self anatta, you understand what we're talking about. Not me, not mind or self. All your worries and concerns, all your cravings, all your problems, all your suffering just vanish. You're gone, baby, you're gone. Wow, wonderful. I'm free at last. I've vanished. Now you understand a little bit what enlightenment means, but I'll give part two of the talk tomorrow. Where does all this lead? Insight and enlightenment coming tomorrow. Very good. I'm sure there'll be some questions in the question box tonight. But I've gone on a bit long, but that's the jhana talk. Nice and interesting, deep, and that's incredibly profound. A few jokes just right now, but it's very, very deep. So anyway, let's have the interviews now. So those who have the interviews, and those who just want to just let go, just let go and have done with it. You're going to get it sooner or later, so just get it out of the way. Very good. Okay.